Democratic socialists are on the ballot in states like Florida, Kansas, and Pennsylvania. And they have their own agenda when it comes to the environment.
We should have environmental policies that ensure that our natural resources remain in the public good to benefit the people here and not corporate interests.
I'm Carol Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, socialists are headed to Harrisburg. And new technology tells researchers how pollution is changing what songbirds eat.
You can think of this like a crime scene investigation where you can identify species of insects rather than an individual.
Plus, this year, some farmers are disappointed as they head out to their pumpkin fields.
No, it's not good, see?
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Electric and hybrid car owners will soon have access to dozens of free charging stations at Pennsylvania's parks and forests. It's part of an effort by the state's Department of Conservation and Natural Resources to reduce its carbon footprint and better serve park visitors. For WHYY in Philadelphia, Sarah Hoover has more.
Washington Crossing Historic Park in Bucks County, where George Washington famously crossed the Delaware, is now the site of another revolutionary move. Stations that can charge up to four vehicles. Park manager George Calaba expects area commuters will welcome the chance to detour into the park to charge up.
People who are heading to work in the morning right here at our crossroads of River Road and State Route 532, every morning it's backed up 50 cars, 30 cars going east, west, north, and south.
More than 1,600 electric cars are operating in the Philadelphia region, and the goal is to highlight green options for those drivers and others, says Cindy Adams-Dunn, who leads the State Department of Conservation and Natural Resources.
It demonstrates and encourages a technology that will frankly help Pennsylvania's environment in the future. So we don't want obstacles for people to make these good environmental decisions.
Installation of nearly 40 charging stations throughout the state is expected by 2020. In Philadelphia, Sarah Hoover.
Whether Harrisburg is ready for them or not, the socialists are coming. Several Democratic candidates running unopposed in state legislature races are members of the Democratic Socialists of America. The group has been gaining some traction since 2016. For State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier looks at what these candidates are saying about the environment.
At a former church-turned-brewery on Pittsburgh's north side, a group of Democratic Socialist candidates are out mingling with donors at a fundraiser. Among the candidates is Elizabeth Fiedler. She's a former public radio reporter at WHYY in Philadelphia, who ran and won a Democratic primary there for state representative because she said she was tired of the two-party system.
Being a Democrat is not enough. It's not enough to me. It's never been enough, and most certainly right now.
Fiedler is running unopposed in the general election and has been endorsed by the Democratic Socialists of America, or DSA, a group that has grown since the 2016 candidacy of Bernie Sanders. Fiedler says both parties are too dependent on corporate donations and thinks their policies reflect that.
When I was knocking on doors in South Philly, people talked about that all the time, whether it was about fracking or the healthcare industry.
Fiedler is one of three DSA-endorsed candidates for state legislature running unopposed on the ballot this year, for whom the environment is a big issue, and who won primaries without running away from the S word. Socialism has been a dirty word in politics for decades, and these days can mean a lot of different things. The DSA advocates for greater public control over the economy by providing more government services in exchange for higher taxes and tighter regulation of industry. The Pennsylvania candidates want a severance tax on oil and gas and more money for the Department of Environmental Protection. Sarah Inamorato is a DSA candidate for state representative in Pittsburgh, who beat a longtime incumbent in the Democratic primary.
We should have environmental policies that ensure that our natural resources remain in the public good and are only used to benefit the people here and not corporate interests.
Though it's gaining popularity among young voters, recent polls show most Americans still have an unfavorable view of socialism. Critics of the DSA say our capitalist system, with lighter regulations on private industry, is the best way to raise the standard of living. Jason Gottesman is a spokesman for the Pennsylvania Republican Party.
You know, it shouldn't be government telling businesses or people how to spend their money or how to best make money. That should be driven by what consumers seem to be important or how businesses feel is best to build themselves.
Gottesman says the type of change democratic socialists advocate would stifle the economy and suppress personal freedoms, like property rights. He thinks the Democratic Party is veering towards socialism. At a coffee shop in Pittsburgh's East End, Summer Lee says she doesn't see the problem with that.
So saying that every person in this nation deserves healthcare, access to healthcare, that everybody deserves environmental justice, if that's socialism, then I will need someone to explain to me what the problem with that is.
Lee won a Democratic primary for state representative over a longtime incumbent. Like Inamorato and Fiedler, she's running unopposed in the general election. She lives in North Braddock, a town overlooking a steel mill that routinely releases toxic air pollution into a poor, majority black community. Demanding the mill clean up its pollution has been part of her pitch from the beginning. Lee and her DSA counterparts have drawn praise from environmental groups like Conservation Voters of Pennsylvania. But Executive Director Josh McNeil says it's not just because of their policies, but how they talk about them.
They were campaigning on issues of environmental justice and environmental racism. Summer Lee may be the first candidate for state office that I've ever seen talk about the inherent racism in a lot of the way that, you know, environmental impacts are distributed in this country.
None of these DSA legislators-to-be expect their ideas to be fully embraced in the statehouse. But one thing they say they can do is to start to change the conversation in Harrisburg. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
It's been a wet summer and early fall, and some area farmers are taking a hit on a seasonal cash crop.
There's not enough pumpkins here for the number of people we're going to have this month, so we will bring more pumpkins into the field.
Coming up later on the Allegheny Front, mushy pumpkins and sad jack-o'-lantern faces. Stay tuned. A new study shows legacy pollution from coal mining is changing how a native songbird eats. It's a modern canary in the coal mine. The Louisiana water thrush is the first migratory bird to arrive in our region from the Caribbean and Central America to breed.
Trout fishermen may know this species, and the water thrush is sometimes referred to as the feathered trout because they inhabit similar sorts of streams, and even forage on similar sorts of insects.
And it's those insects that Stephen Latta, Director of Conservation and Field Research at the National Aviary, has been studying, along with Brian Treveline, a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Pittsburgh. They found that the acid mine drainage from abandoned coal mines that affects thousands of miles of Pennsylvania streams is changing the diet of the Louisiana water thrush that breed on those streams.
Acid mine drainage increases the acidity of the water, which in turn impacts the macroinvertebrates, the small stream insects that the Louisiana water thrush depends on.
Brian, what kind of insects are we talking about?
Ephemeroptera, which are mayflies, plecoptera, stoneflies, and trichoptera, caddisflies. Fly fishermen probably know these insects pretty well, and they're extraordinarily sensitive to all types of organic pollutants as well as acidification. And it just so happens that water thrush are particularly reliant on pollution-intolerant insects. They tend to gravitate towards those for their diet and for the diet of their young.
This is Steve. We've shown that when these insects are not present, the Louisiana water thrush nest in much lower numbers, so much lower density of birds nesting on these streams. They lay fewer eggs, and the chicks that hatch from these eggs are smaller. And that suggests that they're going to have much lower survival rates as well.
So how do you know what Louisiana water thrush are eating to know if it's changed? This is the part that I found the coolest in your study.
This is Brian. So studying the diets of songbirds is actually pretty difficult. In the past, researchers have used chemicals like EpiCac or stomach pumping to force birds to regurgitate their stomach contents. Obviously, this is pretty stressful for those birds. You wouldn't necessarily get great data from that either, because you have to identify insects based on semi-digested little pieces of wings and legs. So what we wanted to do was analyze water thrush diet using a non-invasive technique, just using the fecal samples, in order to sort of understand what their diet is in a non-invasive manner.
So you look at the DNA of the insects that they ate.
Right. The technique itself is called DNA metabarcoding, and it's actually pretty straightforward. Plants and animals all have DNA, and so the sequence of bases within the DNA, meaning the A, T's, G's, and C's that make up the genetic code, they differ between species. These genetic signatures are actually retained even after digestion, so you can identify which insects were in the diet just using the residual DNA present in feces. And you can think of this like a crime scene investigation, where you can identify species of insects rather than an individual.
That's really cool. Is that something that's new to this kind of research?
I would say that it's really picked up in the last 5 years or so. This was something that people were using a lot with bats, like around 2010 or so. And then our group was one of the first to do it in songbirds.
So if they're not eating mayflies and the things that they prefer, what are they eating?
We found that in acidified habitats, they're eating more sort of moths, crickets, spiders, those types of arthropods that are found further away from the stream rather than on the stream, suggesting that the birds are traveling further away from their nests in order to get the adequate food for their young.
So is that necessarily a negative thing?
Not necessarily negative. I mean, it's showing that the birds are compensating behaviorally for the reduced availability of their preferred prey. But it could carry other costs that we're not aware of, and that's sort of what we're looking at now, is what do these differences in diet actually mean for the nestlings? But also, birds go to pretty great lengths to avoid predators, for instance, and the more time they spend away from the nest, the more likely it is that a blue jay or a raccoon or a snake will see them leaving the nest or coming back to the nest frequently, and it sort of reveals it to them where they can eat the nestlings or the eggs. So it could affect survivability of the young. But again, this is something that we don't know at the moment. We're trying to investigate further.
This is Steve. Another aspect that we're looking at is that the quality of these alternative food items may not be the same as the quality of, for example, mayflies or stoneflies are for a water thrush. There's some indication that they might not have the calcium that they really need in order to lay eggs, you know, the same quality eggs. So there's a lot of different sorts of potential ramifications of diet change.
I interviewed a researcher from West Virginia this year who looked at natural gas infrastructure and how it was impacting Louisiana water thrush populations. So is this species especially sensitive to development and pollution?
You know, birds are really good indicators of environmental conditions, and we've known that for many years. I mean, if you go back to our own Rachel Carson, who used birds as indicators of other sorts of contamination from DDT and other contaminants. So we know that birds can be really excellent indicators of the health of their environment. We've shown that the Louisiana water thrush is really an excellent indicator of the health of these riparian systems, these stream systems, especially in the Appalachian Mountains. And so, yes, they are very good bioindicators.
Thank you so much for talking with me.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks.
Brian Travelline and Stephen Latta's study on Louisiana water thrush diets was published recently in the open access journal PeerJ. There's more about Pennsylvania's wildlife at alleghenyfront.org/wildpa. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. Now, from the Halloween desk, we have this report. Heavy rains this year have created a problem for local farmers who grow pumpkins. Fungus.
90.5 WESA's Amy Sisk reports from a pumpkin patch in Butler County.
It's the busiest time of year at many local farms. Think hayrides, animals to pet, apple cider to sip. It's all fun for the preschoolers on a field trip at Harvest Valley Farms. They huddle around a woman who's telling them about all the different fruits and veggies grown here.
Well, what vegetable are you going to pick today?
Later, the kids and their parents traipse around to the pumpkin patch.
This one's, that one's mushy.
While there are plenty of good contenders, quite a few pumpkins have gone bad. Art King owns this farm with his brother and son. He walks with me through one of their fields.
Little muddy here.
We come across a pumpkin gleaming orange in the morning light. He picks it up to inspect.
Anxious to see if it's any good or not. Well, this one is actually good. No, it's not good, see?
A section on the bottom is turned light gray. It's mushy. Same goes for another gourd nearby.
It's called soft rot.
King thinks it's ruined 15% of his pumpkins.
I want to be honest with you. There's not enough pumpkins here for the number of people we're going to have this month. So we will bring more pumpkins into the field.
From a farm in Ohio or a local produce auction. The culprit here is water. Over 46 inches of rain have fallen in the Pittsburgh area this year. On average, only 30 inches usually fall by this time in October. Pathogens like fungus love all the moisture. Lee Stivers is with the Penn State Extension Service in Washington County.
If you talk with most farmers, particularly vegetable farmers, they will say that they'll take a dry year over a wet year anytime.
And that's because they can water their crops when the weather's dry. She assures me she has yet to encounter a year when there were not enough pumpkins to keep kids busy carving jack-o'-lanterns. King recalls a particularly bad season a number of years back.
I can remember a field of pumpkins we had down there across the, next to the creek down there, and coming in August, or was it early September, and it looked like the entire field got frosted, and that was downy mildew.
He says technological advances have helped prevent a repeat. He and Stivers both credit improvements in seeds to make fruits and vegetables more disease-resistant. King shows me how his pumpkins are planted in rows, each elevated alongside a shallow ditch where rainwater collects. Black plastic covers the rows to absorb heat, and pumpkin vines stick out.
It's not a very big hole, because we don't want too much of this. See, it's weeds. So it's not a very big hole, but you poke a hole in the plastic, put one seed in there, and there's your pumpkin plant.
Stivers says more and more farmers are using a system like this instead of growing pumpkins in a flat field.
It helps them manage a year, whether it's a wet year like this year, because those fields will drain better and the crops are better protected, as well as a dry year because it includes a system of irrigation.
It's not totally foolproof. Some of King's pumpkins have grown into the ditches, and those are the ones where fungus has taken hold. Regardless, King says one bad year for pumpkins will not devastate the farm.
It can't. And the reason why is that 100 different varieties that we grow. And this is something that my dad always said. He said, you got to grow different things, he says, because if one thing doesn't do well, another thing will. And that way you're covered.
Even though pumpkins are the highlight, the kids here learning about the farm are pretty excited about all those other crops, like
Potato!
We grow some red ones.
I love
And we grow some purple ones. And some that are even a little pink.
Pink is my favorite color.
For the Allegheny Front, I'm Amy Sisk. In a recent 60 Minutes interview, President Trump said he'd look into a scorching UN climate change report that predicts we have about a decade to lower our carbon emissions before it's too late.
I don't think it's a hoax. I think there's probably a difference, but I don't know that it's man-made.
He made these rather contradictory comments as the Environmental Protection Agency is actively scaling back Obama-era regulations that would have cut back on America's carbon pollution from coal-fired power plants and vehicle emissions. Eric Lipton, an investigative reporter for the New York Times, is all over this beat. He's covering the Environmental Protection Agency, including bringing to light the ties between polluting industries and top agency officials. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier talked with Lipton for the latest episode of our Trump on Earth podcast.
So there are over 70 environmental regulations this administration has begun or attempted to begin rolling back. Can you talk about what you've seen and why you think the Trump administration has been so aggressive in this area?
I think that when Trump was elected, it was clear from the start that one of the primary things that they wanted to do, in addition to filling vacant seats in the federal judiciary, was to eliminate as many of the Obama-era regulations across the spectrum of government. And the EPA and the Department of Interior are two of the agencies where they have moved perhaps the most aggressively and expeditiously to try to undo the Obama legacy. And I think in part that's because Obama was so aggressive himself in terms of using executive powers to expand the federal government's reach at the EPA and Interior. So there's a lot of targets that Trump was able to go after.
So I want to talk about a couple of these rollbacks. One of them is chlorpyrifos. This is an insecticide that the Trump administration tried to keep on the market. Can you explain what chlorpyrifos is and what happened with the rule on chlorpyrifos?
Sure. I mean, there's been quite a number of years of medical research looking at chlorpyrifos, which is used in all kinds of vegetables and fruits in places around the United States. And there had been research that has suggested that there's a correlation between the use of chlorpyrifos and developmental disabilities, lower IQ levels, and other health issues, particularly among the children of farm workers, because this is a pesticide that is sprayed and therefore it gets in the air and it also gets on the clothing and goes back into the households of these farm workers. So there was a consensus among EPA scientists that the research was troubling enough that they thought that it should be removed from the commercial marketplace, that it should be deregistered is the technical term. And that recommendation was presented to the EPA administrator. And in March of 2017, Pruitt, after having had intervention by Dow Chemical, which is the main manufacturer of it, and also agricultural entities that use chlorpyrifos, Pruitt overturned the recommendation of his own scientific staff and decided to keep chlorpyrifos on the market.
What does this show you about how the administration views science, particularly at agencies like the EPA?
I think that there were several signs, particularly during Pruitt's tenure, that the agency's own science was being pushed aside for science that the industry was advocating. There was another example having to do with gliders, which is the type of a truck which they retrofit old trucks that have really antiquated emissions controls, and they essentially rebuild the truck around an old engine, and this allows someone that's buying the truck to avoid modern requirements for emissions controls on diesels. And over the last 20 years, diesel trucks have tremendously improved their emissions, the particulates, the sulfur, the and nitrogen oxides. And so again, in that case, the EPA's own engineers and scientists were like, what's going on here? How is it possible that the EPA could be creating a loophole to allow dirty trucks back on the highways? And chlorpyrifos is similarly an example of science that seemed to be taken under the control of the regulated parties. And a lot of staff was frustrated and surprised and disheartened. And I mean, Pruitt is now out, and it's a little unclear just the extent to which the acting administrator Wheeler is going to continue to sort of embrace industry-funded science, or whether or not he's going to sort of put confidence in his own people's work.
Right. There was a talk of doing a sort of science debate on climate change. That seems to have gone away under Wheeler.
It was actually, apparently, the White House vetoed the idea. There was what they call red team, blue team, where Pruitt was determined to try to challenge the whole endangerment finding, which is the justification for the regulating carbon dioxide. And so there was some talk of having a kind of a mock debate, a public debate about whether or not, you know, climate science and climate change are real. And there's no discussion of that now under Wheeler's tenure.
Another deep in the weeds subject is maybe near and dear to your heart, a new source review. The Trump administration is trying to roll back this regulatory tool. Can you tell us what new source review is and how the administration is trying to change the application of it?
Sure. New source review is a program that the EPA has used really intensely in the last 20 years. It essentially requires older power plants as well as refineries and other factories that are going through renovations, that if you're going to go through a renovation, that you're required to modernize your emissions controls to the most advanced emission controls possible. The argument is that because the United States had improved emissions control requirements over the years, it generally grandfathered older plants because it realized that if it forced them to spend $1 billion to replace all of their emissions controls, it would essentially push them out of business. The conclusion was that they said, okay, well, if you're going to renovate, then you have to bring up the facility to the most modern standard. So that is something that the industry has hated, and they argued that it has discouraged them from making improvements in their facilities. And the Trump administration, one after another, has been finding ways to limit the power of new source review in ways that the industry has been pushing for more than a decade, because they have spent, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars renovating power plants and factories and refineries, and it's a very hated provision. And the Trump people are working aggressively to curtail the power of new source review.
What does this show you about how the current EPA Administrator Andrew Wheeler wants to operate?
The efforts to curb new source review have continued under Wheeler. The replacement program for the Clean Power Plan includes a provision that would allow coal-burning power plants to essentially get an opt-out of new source review if they make changes that reduce carbon emissions. So, I mean, Wheeler continues to, embrace that approach. And, I mean, there are people, including, Jeff Homestead, a former EPA official who now is in the private sector and represents a lot of these companies, who argue that new source review is redundant and expensive, and there are other regulations that do effectively the same thing. I mean, that's an argument that Acting Administrator Wheeler and Bill Wareham, who's in charge of the Air Office of the EPA, have embraced. And they're in charge, and so they're prevailing at the moment.
I mean, do they have a point that these rules are redundant and they make industry spend money without actually giving any public benefit for compliance of these regulations? How have you answered that question in your own reporting?
There's a massive improvements in air quality that results when these plants have to undergo retrofits in their emissions control. So huge reductions in nitrogen oxides and sulfur dioxide. What a person like Homestead argues is that there are other rules that already are requiring those upgrades, and so that this rule is redundant. Now, he's not arguing that the improvements aren't really significant. I mean, there's been a huge reduction in nitrogen and sulfur, which has caused smog and acid rain and really terrible things. But what my reporting tells me is that the engineers and lawyers at the EPA who really do the enforcement, that are the career people that have been there for years, they really rely on new source review as an incredibly important and powerful tool to basically force factories and power plants that don't want to do the modernization to do them. They are really worried that if they lose this tool, that there are particularly refineries and other factories that will go about modernizations and extend their useful life without modern emissions controls. And they're quite worried about it.
Eric Lipton is an environmental reporter for the New York Times, based in Washington, D.C. He spoke with the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier for our podcast, Trump on Earth. There's a lot more of Lipton's insight into Trump's EPA at trumponearth.org or wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.